next little bit. The one little bit I have to do before we get there as another prelude to why we have the problems we have now. Your doctor, well, let's go back one further. How many of you had an ethics lecture in your medical training? Three. The rest of you didn't. I had none, and they didn't happen until the 80s. Now, in most cases, when you talk to people who've had those lectures, their memory of it reduces to four concepts, at best. And they are these: autonomy, justice, beneficence, and non-maleficence. I call it the Georgetown mantra because it came out of Georgetown. I said earlier today that Lewis pointed out that heresy is usually a good thing in a wrong place. Now, just as an exercise, since most of you got pencils or pens, write down for yourself in order of importance, 1, 2, 3, 4. I ask you to write it down because with students, when you want them to remember something or think a bit more, if you tell them the answer, they nod wisely, and very soon they pretend to themselves that they knew it to begin with, and shortly they believe they did know it. Whereas if I've made you write it down and you've got a blank sheet in front of you, you know that you didn't, or you didn't play the game, or you didn't know it. And it's much more intensive as a learning experience if you write it down and find you were wrong. So I also say to students, if you're asked a question, put it the other way around, if there's something you can never remember, ask the professor to ask you in front of 400 students. You'll never forget the answer again. It's a 100% learning experience. You'll remember it for the rest of your life. They've forgotten in 90 milliseconds. They couldn't care less. So, you've had time to write. Yes?
What they should be in order? Or how
well, I've yet to find a medical school where anybody teaches that they're ordered, including Georgetown. Okay. I think they're ordered, and I think I can defend that. Let's just do a sort of Delphic oracle. Who put autonomy first? Oh, well, I'll repeat them first. Autonomy, justice, beneficence, and non-maleficence. Autonomy, justice, doing good and not doing evil. So we've got some who are for autonomy. They're the young in heart, at least. Who's for justice? Who's for beneficence? And who's for non-maleficence? Well, it's pretty evenly distributed. I'm going to make the case that non-maleficence is the foundational one. And the reason for that is scriptural. When Moses gave the law to the children of Israel, he gave it that they might flourish. He reminds them in Deuteronomy that their experience of God, the subjective side of things, pretty strong subjectivity with thunder and lightning and a small volcano and God speaking in a language you understood, that took their free will away. No one who was at Sinai could not believe that God existed after that. But did it make them able to keep the law? No. They broke it while Moses was still up the mountain in order, you know, the first three commandments gone. So the experience of God does not make us good. So if an experience like that wouldn't serve to make a nation good, what will? And that's where what we're talking about earlier comes in, teaching the stories to the children. And the law that Moses gave, which is the source of Western law, the better scholars acknowledge it, the 10 divine intolerances, they're the 10 things that God says, I will not accept from you. And he didn't do it out of malice or wanting to show power. Who can tell me what the verse was that precedes the first thou shalt not in both Exodus 20 and Deuteronomy 5?
I am the Lord your God who brought you out of Egypt.
That's right. Now, could they get out of Egypt on their own? No. So isn't it interesting? Grace introduces the law, even in the Old Testament. The first thing is an act of grace. So did did God change his character between bringing them out of Egypt and saying, thou shalt not? No. So they are not an imposition. The best single sentence for it that I know was from Pope John Paul II. He said, the law is the framework within which freedom can flourish. That's brilliant. As an aphorism. Without a framework, it won't work. Now, once you've got in place an understanding of what God says will destroy your flourishing, you can obviously extrapolate to the good. It's the opposite, so to speak. Our moral cosmos is not expanding like we think the physical one is. It goes from good to evil, love to hatred, justice to injustice, fidelity to infidelity. You can see how it works. And I mean, when you've got to lies, you've got to the end of that dimension and truth on the other end. So we have to live in the middle, and that's not easy. I think we do that by cultural stories, and I've been, so far in this conference, basically filling in the cultural story of the Western world. We will be coming back to that many times en route. Now, once you've got beneficence in place, now you can get to justice. Without a fixed law, you can't. And only when those are in place can freedom be truly free. For the modern student, if you ask them what they mean by freedom, what do they say? Not being interfered with. Being allowed to do what I want to do. That's not freedom, that's anarchy. It's only a question of how long it takes to get there. And what we're talking about now, for the next little bit, is sexual anarchy. That's where we've got to. He goes right back to Protagoras, or Protagoras, whichever way you like to pronounce him, in the, what was it, 4th or 5th century BC anyway. And the famous statement, man is the summit of things to say what is that it is and what is not that it is not. He taught Alcibiades, who destroyed Greece by saying, we can capture Sicily, which was beyond the reach of the Greek economy, and the net result was that he destroyed Greece. When you get to the stage of believing that you're the authority, destruction is on the way. Now, I need to say a little bit about the justice as well, because in Canada we have a much bigger problem than you have. There's not a single judge on our court who actually thinks that they discover the law. They think they make it. They modify what Parliament has done to make it a tool for social engineering. And they're open about it. And the whole of the legal system says that. So now that this last month they told doctors in Ontario that, yes, the Charter of Rights says you have religious freedom, but it does say with reasonable limitations. And so you do not have the right not to take part in euthanasia, because the desire of the public to have a medical profession that will provide this service outweighs your religious freedom. That's historically worse than naive, and hopefully it will be reversed at some point, but not immediately. So the best description of the problem of justice that I know is in Arthur Leff. Now, have I used that with you this? No, I've used it twice last week, so that's the reason. I use it a lot because it fulfills one of my key criteria for making difficult statements. You want to find somebody who doesn't believe who sees the truth. An atheist who speaks the truth is gold, as far as I'm concerned. And in this case, it's a man called Arthur Leff, L-E-F-F. If you put Justice Leff, Duke Law Review, 1979, into Google, you'll get to the article. The title is one of those academic ones. You can do it several ways around. So it's something like Unnatural Law, Unspeakable Justice. And he was a famous and much loved professor at Yale. He taught common law. And way back in the 70s, he began to be worried about his students, rather like another Jew, Robert Fogel, with his economics students 30 years later. But he didn't trust them. And so he gave this talk at Duke to clarify his own thought. And it the first paragraph I can paraphrase for you, and you'll see what's at stake. He says, I want to believe, and so do you, in a complete immanent, that's a technical term meaning accessible to you, not imminent next week, but immanent, a philosophical term, but it means that you can understand it, and transcendent, from beyond us, from God, set of rules, propositions that direct us as to how to live our lives righteously. Now, as far as I can discover, he was an unbelieving Jew. But clearly in writing that, he sees the benefit of having a law spoken to us by God. Because then you have an authority above the judges. If they don't believe in God, and they are Darwinians, why would they not make a law that benefits their group? Which is what they do. And he saw that problem coming. So he goes on, but he understands. He says, but I also want to believe in no such thing as an immanent and transcendent set of propositions, but rather that we are wholly free to decide for ourselves what we ought to do and what we ought to be. What we want, heaven help us, is to be simultaneously perfectly ruled and perfectly free. That is, at the same time, to discover the right and the good and to invent it. Not even Americans can have both. You have one or the other. Which one is America choosing by and large? It's autonomy as individual choice dominating everything else. But in your court, you have at least half who understand that won't work. In our court, none. Now, Leth then does something very unacademic. He writes 20 pages of lucid prose. We don't do that very often, particularly in the social sciences. You spend a year learning to speak their lingo, but not with him. And he weighs the pros and cons of this dilemma, very honestly. But at the end, there's a sad last two paragraphs. He's at Yale in the 1970s. Social Darwinianism is dominant, and he can't bring himself to buck the trend. So he says, it looks to me as though we are all that we have. In other words, time plus chance, and Darwin is right. But he's still honest. He can't get away from it. He says, looking around the world, this is an extraordinarily unappetizing prospect. If brotherly love exists, the ruling model appears to be Cain and Abel. And to modern students, I now have to explain who Cain and Abel were, because they no longer know. Such is the state of our education system. They're in our highly immigrant, heavy country of Canada, much more than yours on a population base. There are students in any medical class who will not understand the sentence, if you take that job, it will be a crown of thorns. It has no, you mean it won't be very good? No historical reference at all for many immigrants from other cultures and other religions. Why should there be? But it's important to realize what it means. He says, only if the law was unnatural and unspeakable by us would it be unchallengeable. As things stand now, everything is up for grabs. And he's the first legal scholar that I know of who made it that blatantly obvious. That the law, following Roe v. Wade in particular, this was just 6 years after Roe v. Wade, the one dissenting judge in the Roe v. Wade decision said the same thing, and Leff is picking it up at that level. That judge said, this judgment is not an act of legal scholarship, but an act of power. And three faculties in the modern university teach that. Women's studies, black studies, and homosexual studies all teach that the law is about power, not about justice. The most egregious example of that would be Martha Nussbaum, who was at Harvard when this happened, a very good scholar, has written some very good stuff, but also very much part of the gay, lesbian group, And some years ago, I forget the date, there was, I always forget the name of, you have write-in things on your elections, what propositions you call them, don't you? Yeah. There was a proposition in this state, Colorado, which said that homosexuals need human rights just like all of us. They do not need special rights. And Coloradans agreed with that, overwhelmingly. Which, of course, was unacceptable to the homosexual agenda. And so they argued that this was evidence of religious prejudice from Christians. And they took it to court. Now, they did not know that John Finnis, a Catholic scholar from Oxford, who had written a lot about this, was actually in America at the time. So the proposition case was made by John Finnis very effectively. So it was important that the anti-side found someone to trash Finnis. And Martha Nussbaum did it very cleverly so that she didn't commit perjury, but she even went against her own work. When asked afterwards why she had done it, she said it was necessary for the cause. That's the world we live in, and we'd better get used to it. Not to recognize that is to be foolish. So that's the background to what we come to now. Now, modern students will put autonomy top of the list. And that's why they will accept whatever anyone wants. So the transgender movement and its sudden outbreak, because it's really been quite remarkable the way it's happened. I mean, up until a few years ago, the prevalence of transgender behavior, and certainly going as far as surgery, was sort of 0.2 noughts before you got to the digit in a percentage of the population. I mean, nothing. They are a very, very small group. Now, in the last few years, it's gone mad with this kind of hysterical behavior where, particularly in high school, in a matter of years, it's gone from no one to several per year. And in some places, girls in particular have done it almost as a group. And the courts, being what they are, certainly in our country, are backing it up to the hilt. A Christian in family in British Columbia, father did not want his teenage daughter to become a boy. And he was told that if he did not assist with it, the child would be put in care and allowed to get it that way. And there are accounts of young women going off to university and coming home with a beard. And sometimes without their breasts. Mastectomies are being done on prepubertal girls. That's unbelievable. Interesting enough, one of the most interesting people you can find to talk about this is Camille Paglia. And that's astonishing. Camille Paglia is a libertarian of the First Order. Bisexual, professor in Philadelphia, very smart, but also very honest. And she is appalled at this. And it's going to drive a wedge through the alphabet soup group. They will not have a lot in common by the time this is finished. The feminists in particular are having huge problems as they try and think their way through this. It will fracture them. But Paglia says, no, this is child abuse. You're not allowed to vote or drink alcohol, but you can have you can be turned into a eunuch without knowing what fertility is. This is child abuse, and she can work herself up into quite a performance online. It's worth watching, but she's very clear about what's going on. And of course, she's a classicist, and she said, "Of course, we know this is not the first time. It's happened before. It happens when societies decay." The one I gave you from Toynbee, he was not a historian of the arts, but she is, and she points out that you can always tell when a culture is decaying because their statuary changes. Sculpture will produce a David at its high point, who you could see, all man. And as the Greeks in particular showed, they had a period when you could see very clearly this was a man plus plus. But as they decayed, the men become more effeminate. The poses are more effeminate. It's what always happens. So she presumes that that's what's happening to us. Now, where do you go to read about it? Because most of the stuff is very definitely with an agenda. This is the best one I know for you guys. The New Atlantis had a whole edition on sexuality and gender, and it's the fall edition of 2016. The price on my copy is $7. If they've got any sense, they've doubled it by now. I'm sure they've had to reprint it. The two main authors, Lawrence Meyer is a British epidemiologist who took a lot of flack for doing this. The other major player is Paul McHugh, who was at Johns Hopkins. Now, I didn't take any, or didn't take much interest in transgenderism at all until my wife told me that Alan and Aaron and she had agreed that I would talk about it. Of course, doing the kind of pediatrics I did, transsexuals were part of the deal. And I assumed at first sight that that would be what you needed to know. But transsexualism, the intersex states are, I mean, they have nothing to do with transgenderism, nothing. They always quote the syndromes that we have. There's about 20 different varieties of gender abnormalities, ambiguous genitalia or hormone differences. And they were all sorted out a long while ago. In fact, they were sorted out before we had chromosomes in the days of good clinical medicine in the 19th century. The descriptions of diseases in the 19th century and before are much better than they are now because, A, the people spent a lot of time reading the classics and they could all speak Greek. They knew how to write. You read Bright's description of Bright's disease, as it's called, and it's beautifully written. And that was true of the 19th century. They wrote well. And so they worked it out empirically. You still do to a degree in pediatrics. You're asked to see a child who's obviously not quite normal because nobody knows whether to call it a boy or a girl. It's got ambiguous genitalia. But you've got to tell the parents how to bring it up. And so people, first of all, delineated the syndromes. You make various measurements that you can make, and then you look it up in what we somewhat politically incorrectly call the funny-looking kid book, where all the photographs are, and you say, oh, it looks like that one. You compare all the things you've got, and you get to the syndrome in due course. And then empirically in the 19th century, they made a decision, and they watched what happens, and they made adjustments over time. So we pretty well get them right in terms of how you bring them up. A few will change their own gender description at puberty, but most of them don't, even when they do get a bit more of the opposite sex at puberty. Most of them, I mean, they've got enough to deal with, and they just live their lives as they come their way. They take the cards they've been dealt, if you like. That's amazing to watch. There is one group of people somewhere in the Caribbean who have one of these variants, and they are used to some girls becoming boys at puberty. It doesn't show until that point, and they just switch at that point, and everybody's used to it. There's no fuss, as there is with us at the moment. So I thought that was all okay. This is where Paul Goldberg, who I mentioned at the beginning of this series, where his book comes in. Because in the 70s, I think was the date of publication, smart sociologist from New York, Jewish, very academic, he asked himself the question, has anybody thought about the issue of gender from a neutral position? And was surprised to find that, in effect, pediatricians had. They'd just done it empirically. But they'd done it in the 19th century, and nobody had updated it, really, because it was done. We knew what to do. We're very practical. But he came at it from a theoretical point of view, and he said, well, this has got to be easy. You just make a spreadsheet, and it'll all fall out. But, of course, the first thing he had to discover was that the Y chromosome is not helpful, because testosterone is not on the Y chromosome, because both men and women have testosterone. That's not where the problem lies. That worried, that upset him a bit. And he didn't quite know what to do. And then he's a smart man. He realized that birds in particular, but not only birds, go from male to neuter. The female's a female. And they don't need hormone secretion to get on with what females do. But men need testosterone to become a male. But you see it in your gardens every year. The American robin is a very good example. When they arrive in the spring, what's the noticeable thing that happens? We've got about 6 pairs in our garden, so we see it very clearly. They're very different between spring, April, May, and fall. Now, I see you're not bird watchers. They fight when they arrive in the spring because they're marking out their territory. And they can fight. But in the fall, a couple of years ago, I went up the field, and to my astonishment, I saw a tree that was literally full of robins. They're all getting ready to migrate together, and I just happened to see them all congregate in this tree. No, they weren't fighting at all, because they were neuter by that stage. African finches are the ones that Goldberg chooses, and they're the same. So he said, what is it that does this? And of course, it's testosterone that does it. That surprised him. So it's testosterone that accounts for male violence. You take it away, it doesn't happen. And all these athletes who are taking testosterone, they'll tell you, it makes you more aggressive. And the girls are taking it too for the same reason. And they're all going to have problems. This is the world we live in now. And you can see where you keep pushing the envelopes. If you decide by your choice what sort of person you ought to be physically, that seems perfectly reasonable to them. The question you always have to ask is, what underlies your choices? I mean, as a Christian, you wouldn't do that. Why? Because you look upon that as something that's God's province and not yours. We were given the nature and the role we were given, and we learn a lot by accepting it and living with it. Both sides envy the other at various times. It looks from the transgender movements as though men envy women more than women envy men, and that would seem sensible to me, because the language between men and women would seem to indicate that quite often as well. But that's certainly what the figures indicate at the moment. So Goldberg was stunned by this. Now, he was doing this in a larger sexual context because the book he wrote, as I think I told you, was called The Inevitability of Patriarchy. But that might have been last week as well. Did I mention that? Did I mention Goldberg in the books I gave out this morning? No. In that case, I must correct that. It's the trouble we're doing a similar talk within 10 days of one another. Let me give you the books that are needed for this bit. Goldberg is the first, The Inevitability of Patriarchy. Then the New Atlantis, which I've given you there. Now, my wife said I'd get in trouble with these bits of paper. And as usual, she's proved to be right. Himmelfarb comes in again. I mentioned her this morning, didn't I? Her work is well worth reading, beautifully done. Who else do I have on this list? It's worth looking at Jordan Peterson online on transgenderism. He's very good. Camille Paglia and Hate that I showed you today has done good things in this direction. Yeah, those are the ones that I needed for you to know. So Goldberg was interested in the early part of the feminist theory as to why men do dominate. And there are several reasons that have come up now. One is interestingly described by Jordan Peterson. The mean IQ of men and women is identical. But there's something very different about our IQs. What is it? Different shape curves. Women have a much steeper curve with narrow standard deviations. So women are more like one another than men are. The men's curve has a bump at the bottom for idiots. And it has a long tail at the top. And virtually everybody who's won a Nobel Prize is 5 standard deviations from the mean. And there are many more of them who are men because we have the long tail of male development. The default development for a human ovum is female, which doesn't fit exactly with the biblical story at first sight, but if nothing is done, it becomes a woman. Only if testosterone washes the cell inside, gets inside the cell, does it become a male. And female cells have a means of repelling that, blocking that testosterone. So in utero, the female cell does not see on the inside testosterone the male cell does. And that's what makes a difference. So in fact, to know how even the intersexes are going to work out now, you only need 2 facts, really. Was this baby washed in utero around 10 weeks? And will testosterone be the dominant hormone at puberty? If that is yes, then it's going to be a male, and you do everything you can to help it grow up male and do what will help. We'll come to what helps and what doesn't in just a moment. If it's the other way around, you do the opposite. Now, if it wasn't washed in utero by testosterone, but it's going to have estrogen at puberty, the normal practice has been to remove the source of estrogen because they've had that many years of exposure to being brought up as a male. Almost all of them are infertile anyway, so you're not changing that in this case. So that's the background, and we thought we were home free at that. But then Goldberg comes along and starts talking about the inevitability of patriarchy because testosterone leads to violence, and because of, he didn't know about the distribution of IQ. Men are also more competitive than women. Women are being taught that they should be more competitive, and they're taking testosterone at sports to become more competitive. But by nature, women are much better at winning their arguments in more subtle ways. And they're very good at that. And when you're foolish when you play to somebody else's strengths. You should try and make them play to your strengths. But that's where we're at. But men are very, very competitive. And the result of that is they actually work many more hours than women do overall. And they have a capacity to go on working for very long periods. I mean, think of Handel basically writing The Messiah without hardly sleeping. And Newton did a large amount of the Principia with very little sleep. We can run on that ambition thing. As one great poet put, let not ambition mock. Yes.
But what about the women that are working to enable these men?
Oh, yeah, but it's a different...
That's work, too.
Oh, I'm
I
not...
These women are working very hard. They're working hard all day long, and then they're coming home and working very hard.
Total agreement. Total agreement. But it's not in that competitive way. Men work very hard at competitive things. Women work very hard because it's good. They're nicer than we are. I told my daughters, the most important thing you've got to do is civilize a couple of white males or black males. I don't care what color they are, but males, civilize them. And that's what women do to men. And if you want to reduce violent crime, you want to marry all the males before they get to 22. It would drop violent crime. I mean, there'd be crime inside the family, but it would be much less. So your energies are very different. Yeah.
We have a niece who is extremely competitive.
Yeah, this is a statistical statement, not a total one.
I give you an example.
There are many examples. But there are no, until this year, there hadn't been a female winner of the Nobel, well, it's not a Nobel Prize for mathematics, that's why it should have been. This year. But that's one. Oh, yes. And do you like them? We are very, very different at this respect. The other one that's got to me that's in the transgenderism is the fact that children growing up today are having much less freedom than they had in the past. They're being watched by their parents all the way. I was talking to a girl at breakfast. Did I say this? I might have done because I got up early and I wanted a coffee, so I had to go up. I knew there'd be somebody in the kitchen. I needed some milk for my coffee. So I ended up talking to the three kids that were there. And I asked them Jonathan Haidt's question, not from the video you saw today, but another one, about when did you first go out of the house? And Mum said, fine, be back for lunch, and didn't ask where you were going. When did that first happen? And one of the girls there said, I'm 19, it hasn't happened yet. I went to primary school on my own. I told my mother, I knew where it was, and Brian, a boy 1 year older than me, six, he was going to school, I'd go with him. I didn't need her to come. By the time I was 15, I was riding my bicycle to Venice and back. Freedom was the norm. Of course, you got scrapes, you got into trouble in various ways, but that's what gives you the capacity to handle life. The entitlement syndrome we deal with all the while now is just the fact that many young people, anybody who went after the invention of the iPhone in particular, have been watched over the whole of their lives. Their parents are so possessive, so, I don't know, fearful of abduction and all sorts of things like that, which, if you take out divorce situations, the abduction rate is not that much greater. And the trading, of course, is in children from other parts of the world. But it's made a big difference. So they haven't got used to being told no. Because when you go out off on your own, you find out how the world works, what policemen are for. That's an interesting experience the first time. But you learn those things. And you learn how to negotiate. They haven't had to do any of those things. It's vitally important. They're not having sex. The rates have dropped. They don't even bother to get their driving license. You guys all got your driving license the day it was due, and you were angry if the date was Sunday, right? That's not happening now. They stay home, and what do? The boys and girls. Their phones, right. But the boys and girls do different things. What do the boys do? They get to that later, but it's video games first. What do the girls do? Instagram, right? Getting thumbs up and thumbs down on what everybody thinks about them. Does it surprise you their suicide rate since iPhones came on board has gone up 75% in that age group? This is the world we're dealing with. So there have always been a few people who did the transgender thing. The most famous one was in England. Was a guy, I was a mountaineer, rock climbing was my passion, so I knew of him. This was a guy who was the Times correspondent on the Everest expedition that got to the top of Everest just in time for the Queen's coronation in 1953. So he's a tough guy. But he was one of the first to change his sex. His wife had to divorce him under British law, but they still lived together. And when the law was changed a few years ago, they married again. Now, that's a very unusual. No flagrant behaviour or anything like that. And she is one of the best travel writers you find. Beautiful writer. His name I currently have forgotten. But
Jan Morris.
That's right. Yeah, Jan Morris. Thank you. Worth looking at. She wrote a book about it too called Conundrum, or he. which I never got round to reading, but perhaps nowadays I should, given what's going on, because it would certainly be thoughtful. But very rare, in other words. And now, suddenly an epidemic. How many of you have had to deal with people who've been changing their sex? Well, let's open this up a bit at this stage. What's been the biggest problem for you? What? How to talk to them, yeah. Do you use their pronouns? Yes.
I think a particularly specific problem is partly administrative with the computer system.
Oh, yeah.
Like you go from male to female in the computer, and now you're looking at this person trying to say, well, there's male problems that I need to think about, but they're often vice versa. Like,
and follow-up's becoming difficult on the computer as well, because they change their name and their health number as well. In Canada.
So you can't... They're not even there.
Yeah. They have come de novo, out of nowhere.
While they're transitioning, they may be male on the chart, but they're identifying female, but it hasn't changed on the chart yet. So therefore, there's that conflict there to when you discover, or you're unaware.
Yeah. It was this, of course, that took Jordan Peterson into the public arena. How many of you don't know about Jordan Peterson so far? Most of you do. A few don't. You will find out about him. He is a professor of psychology at Toronto. In fact, he's been the most funded academic psychologist in Canada for years. Always had the biggest grant from the Social Sciences Research Council every year. Now, about 3 years ago, I guess it would be, I don't know, three to four years ago. The transgender students started demanding that he use their pronouns in class. And he said, in talking to you individually, I would like to accommodate you, but what you're asking me to do is very difficult to do as an academic, because you are trying to change the language arbitrarily for everyone. Now, language is too important to allow you to do that without a lot more thought. If you invent a good word, everybody will use it. Just think of the number of words we use now that have been invented by the computer industry. And everybody uses them because they're good words. They have a real word-like function. But these words that you're asking us to use are confusing to everyone. Most of us are not capable, especially now on YouTube in New York. I think there are 40 pronouns available. We can't. Ordinary people have difficulty remembering our children's names, let alone 40 pronouns. Yeah. So that's where it got to. So he said no. What did the students do? Straight to the administration. And what did the administration do? Bend immediately and said, you have got to accommodate them. He said, I won't. I'm tenured. You can't do anything about that. Then two things happened which brought him into the public arena. They caught him, sort of ambushed him on the campus, and somebody filmed it. That's the good news now. Things get filmed. And it went viral. People thought, this is disgraceful. Even worse, we have a very good public policy program in Canada. At least between 8 and 9 every weeknight, there's an hour on TVO, which will be serious discussion about public policy and politics with no advertising. And the guy who interviews there, Steve Paikin, is a very good interviewer, tries very hard to accommodate all views, and he manages to get very good discussions going. And so he did one with Jordan Peterson and a crazy professor from the other side. The crazy professor just demonstrated how crazy he was, and Jordan Peterson demonstrated how he kept his cool under all circumstances. Anyway, of course, those things are available as downloads afterwards, and there was one student who used that program to teach in her tutorial group at another university. She was doing graduate studies, but they taught tutorial groups. She simply played a clip. She didn't make a comment about it. She said, it'd be good for you to to talk about this. One of the students complained to the university, so she was hauled up by two professors and an administrator who were all on the same side of this equation. And she realized when she saw who wanted to bring her up in front of this committee, and she knew it was disciplinary, so she was smart enough to put a tape recorder in her bag and recorded the whole thing. And they reduced her to tears. She was very good, and then she put it out there. And, of course, it went viral. And said professors had to disappear from sight for a while. And Jordan Peterson came to her rescue as well, because a lawyer had said to him, look, this is an important issue. I will defend you in public for free. So what happened next was really extraordinary, because Jordan Peterson didn't get his grant for the first time in 20-plus years. I mean, this is clearly politics. He was very upset about it. I met him shortly after this, and he said, well, I got very upset. And in fact, I wasn't sleeping well. And one night I woke up being called a bigot and all the usual names, transphobic, whatever you want. And he said, I'm none of those things. So he got up in the middle of the night and he put one of his lectures online. And over the next few nights, he did some more. And he kept doing it. And then after a few weeks, he said, I wonder if anybody's looking at them, or am I just doing a little psychotherapy on myself? And he was astonished. Thousands were already looking at it. And then he went on Patreon, and he did quite a longer video describing this whole experience and how much money he'd lost and how upset he was, because many students who were serious about being academic psychologists had organized their life to have Jordan Peterson as their supervisor, and now the money was gone. The people on Patreon gave him all the money he'd lost and more in about a month. And then he went viral by debating a feminist who makes her money by destroying clever men on BBC, on television in England, and he took her apart. And then that went viral as a single film in the millions in a week. And now he's the world's most famous intellectual, public intellectual at the moment, recognized in every city in the world. And always by young men, and they always want to say, thank you. That's all. Thank you. You told me I was wasting my life playing video games, and I needed to get up in the morning and make my bed as a symbol of my intent to impose order on my world. To go out there and take responsibility for something and take the flack that goes with it. And you said I'd feel better, and I do. That's astonishing. And as Christians, we need to think about that. That a message as simple as that could have such a profound effect. But he's also, of course, taken on the transgender movement on the grounds that this has got to be called nonsense. I mean, how can you possibly rationalize a pre-pubertal child turning themselves into a eunuch? Which is what they do, and that's what it ought to be called. They're not turned into a woman or turned into a man because they're not fertile, and they cannot be. They are eunuchs dressed in drag. That's what they actually are. Now, there have always been people who like cross-dressing. That's, you know, it's culturally been around forever in one form or another. So that's not new. But what surprised me, appalled me when Sally told me, I thought I'd better go and look online about what's there. Yeah, I was appalled at what I discovered. It disturbed my sleep for a week or two, and I'm sure I was quite miserable. I've been there, done that, it's over now. But the worst thing for me is if you put mothers feminizing their sons into Google, that is absolutely appalling. This is, you know, 5 and 6-year-olds. When they should be out, boys playing in the mud and tearing their clothes and beating one another up and the things that little boys do. And instead they're sitting in white dresses with girls' clothes and makeup being photographed. What on earth is going on? Largely women who don't have men around, of course. And then you get the others around who are doing it off their own, of their own initiative. But not receiving any serious care. And the guy who's been looking at this problem longest, a guy called Drucker in Toronto, and he came to the same conclusion that McHugh did, that 95% of children who have gender dysphoria will accept their biological sex by the time they're late teens. So what would any doctor do normally under those circumstances? I mean, we are conservative by nature, and rightly so. Wait until they've had a chance to get through this patch of life without making an irreversible choice. But the government closed that guy's clinic down. He did hire a lawyer, and the government had to pay him $1 million. But nevertheless, his clinic was closed. With the guy with the longest experience kept it all written out and down, and he was attacked by the elite libertarians. I suspect, but I'm not sure, that the people who have the most interest in, certainly not the lesbians, but the male homosexuals, the ones of that variety, because, of course, what they've got is males who look like females that they can use. Now, that phenomenon is common in Thailand and has been for years. I know nothing about it. Some of you may. Does anybody have any experience of that? In Thailand, there's been an area of prostitution, which is basically boys who were castrated and they look like girls. I don't know what the history is. Any other, those of you who've been dealing with this, do you have any more wisdom to give us on this?
Well, my experience is not with people that...
You should say that you're a psychiatrist,
yeah,
too.
I'm a psychiatrist in the state prison here at Univista. I've been working here 4 years. After 6 months from on high, came the dictum that psychiatry was going to be doing the endocrinology for all the transgenders in the prison. And what's a transgender in prison? It's somebody who... for a variety of different reasons, later in life declares, I'm a woman. And then you give them spironolactone to suppress the testicular testosterone, and you give them spirits to feminize them. And I'm a Christian, I'm a Bible-believing Christian, who never dreamed you would do that, but I figured I would do it just to get on the inside of it to see what was happening. And I'm sure this is different than the group that's being feminized by mother.
Yeah, that's a very special group, yeah.
Yeah. But the thing that's striking, you can say a lot about these men. There's many different motivations. Sometimes they're just bored because prison's boring, and this will give them some notoriety. Or many of them are sex offenders, and they may believe that their appeal will be received more kindly if they are now women instead of, you know, malevolent males. They're women. But the thing that never seems to change is exactly what you described, Dr.
It's all right, Karen. John will do.
Peterson.
Yeah.
Which is this competitiveness.
Yeah.
And the best example I have is where we have an exhaustive four-page, I've never seen an informed consent form as long as this. It's you know, single space, 4 pages, all these checkboxes of morbidities and risks and probabilities, you know, thrombosis, and breast cancer, that, and heart attacks, and whatnot. And the abandon with which these men go through this thing without really a serious consideration of the morbidity. And one fellow was so irritated that I wanted to slow down and say, now, do you understand how this is going to cause breast cancer? I guess it was after the treatment, the guy's prolactin began to rise up. I can't remember what else was on the index. Suspected or suggested he was at risk for breast cancer. And he said, doesn't matter to me. Raise my dose of the estrogen. And I said to him, let's call him Mr. Smith or John. John, you know, I've never met a woman who, if I told her, giving you this medicine or raising that dose would double your risk of breast cancer, she would say, stop it immediately. A real woman would do that. Mm. And I'm puzzled that you're not reacting that way. Yet you say you're really the woman. And he had no answer for it. He didn't get angry. She didn't get angry. But it was so striking how full speed ahead, male bullheadedness persists, even though now we're women. And it's a different species entirely.
Yep.
It's not female. You get to know them, you see them every 2 or 3 months. And then those that are really public, they're going to get out of parole. Many of them want to be drag queens and run these vaudevilles. I can't remember exactly what they call them.
They have womanless pageants now.
They're like bars and different venues for these folks. And they're gleeful about fooling people. It's not that I'm really a woman. I'm not fooling. If I'm really a woman, I'm not fooling anybody anymore. I'm just a woman. But now I'm this novelty. I'm a man who's become a woman. And you're not sure what I am. And there's a sort of a celebration of the ambiguity that is, that's a kind of inner sense. And that's pretty common.
Yep.
This sort of wink of the eye as this whole thing goes on. And so I contend that it's false. It's fraudulent. It's deceptive, both to those of us who are on the outside having to put up with it and watch our pronouns, but it's deceptive to them because they're taking on. Nobody knows in 10 years, 15 years, what this chemical suit.
But we do know something about that. That's where McHugh comes in. Because McHugh was the psychiatrist in charge of the intersex program from a psychiatric point of view at Johns Hopkins. And of course, initially we'd worked it out, as I said, and so we made attempts to make the anatomy fit what the hormone profile was going to be. It turned out that that didn't help them.
Well, but
the
suit. That's
right. And in fact, the suicide rate is higher in those who have corrective surgery than those who didn't. So McHugh stopped the program. Now, you can imagine how unpopular he is with the transgender activists at the moment, which is why this had to be done, because you couldn't publish this stuff in the medical literature directly. So the editor of the New Atlantis said, okay, we'll do it this way.
We had our last quarterly meeting, most recent quarterly meeting, where the announcement was made that now the psychiatrists aren't going to have to administer these meds anymore. It's going to be the internal medicine and family practice and APNs. They're going to have to do it. And I was very surprised. I'm the only believing Christian in this group of 20 people.
Yep.
Half of them, they started clapping. They said, oh, great. I mean, the room became alive with comment.
Yep.
About how great this was. They don't know no longer going to have to do it. So there's a real preservation of a sense of, I guess I call it black and white.
Yep.
In many of these people, simply because they are good physicians.
Yep.
And conversely, the medical departments are, pissed off.
Yes.
They're going to have to do this now.
Yep. Well, keep your eye open for the stuff coming out of Far Curlin's theology and medicine program at Duke, because the project is to divide the American health system on the basis of morality, not on the basis of anything else. Because medicine is at heart a moral activity, not a technical one. Because it's very easy to demonstrate, does a patient have to take your advice? No. So what are you doing in a medical interview? You are helping patients to decide what they ought to do, right? Now, ought and should and must are not scientific words. That's philosophy and theology. So your activity as a doctor at heart is a moral activity. That's also why medicine was still appreciated before we had an effective treatment. Up until 1863-4, you were more likely to die if you went to the doctor than if you didn't. That was the first year that it was that the way around that we think it ought to be. But people appreciated the doctor, basically for help with decisions and for prognosis, which we did know something about, and thereby relieving anxiety about what do I have to do. You say, this is going to kill you in X time, then you know what you've got to do with your life, and you can get it organized. But you need to learn to insist that medicine is at heart a moral activity. And then we have, that will open up for us the reasons for dividing. You see, America, the Western world, is no longer a society or a nation in one sense, because a society is formed by what we hold in common. You can't form a society out of difference. You can celebrate it, and when it comes to cooking, it's very welcome, right? But some things are not very welcome. The women, I'm sure, here would not look forward to the legalization of honor killings and adultery being a reason to murder the woman, which it is in many parts of the world. So if it's a moral activity, then the Catholics have thought about what you do. We haven't, largely. How many of you have heard of the doctrine of subsidiarity? Just one. Two. Well, subsidiarity is something you need to think about. The Catholics thought about it in the 19th century. And it's about how you deal with public policy when there is not moral agreement. And their solution is that health and education are both the same thing. Where there is no moral agreement about the nature of education or health, then the government's job is simply to decide how much of the tax dollars should be allocated to health and to education. And then the actual distribution of the money is pushed down in society to the level where there is moral agreement. And you let them work it out. You can then look at the results over time, and if one group produces much better results than the other, undeniably better, then you can say that's the way we're going to go. So it could be a way to get society back again. But most of the people who come to North America, why do they come? Because they think American society is great? No, they come because they think they can make a better living for themselves here. They have no intention, unlike the immigrants of the 19th century who wanted to become Americans. Most of the immigrants today do not have that intention. And we need to think about what that means. But in medicine, discussion of subsidiarity can open this up as being an effective public policy which has justice attached to it that everyone could recognize. It would mean Muslim schools. It would mean Muslim hospitals if the numbers warranted. But but you would then have to look at the outcomes, and the nation as a whole has the right to say we don't like that outcome and close it down. So be ready. At some point, it seems to me that we will need to do what has been done in Birmingham in the last year. Birmingham is the biggest Muslim city outside of the Islamic world, where I grew up. Where Tolkien grew up is now a no-go place for the police. It's a Muslim area. Quite near to the school I went to and he went to. It's encroaching. So that needs a lot of thought. But this year, the liberals in Birmingham developed a program for sex education which said no one excluded, and had explicit teaching to young children about different forms of sexuality and the families that came from it. Who do you think revolted against that? The Muslims. And they got 600 parents to remove their children from school until that was changed, and they won. We don't show that kind of guts. But I think as doctors, we tried to start a Hippocratic registry 20 years ago, and we've never got over 2,000. We ought to have at least 30% of the medical population who would agree to the four basic insights of Hippocrates, that without transcendence, you trust your doctor less, not more. that medicine is a moral activity, that the sanctity of life is the key test, and that therefore you should give to your doctor rights of conscience. Those go right back to Hippocrates. Those four principles are enough for a lot of people who are not Christian, nevertheless, to say, that's the kind of medicine I'd prefer. And be willing to withdraw your labour if the kind of decision that was made in Ontario last month, that if you will not do euthanasia, you better find a job as a dermatologist. They don't care. You can train all your life and boom, it's gone. That's probably enough bad news for one night, isn't it? Yeah, of course you can. I couldn't stop you.
It's about transgender. So, in the decay of society, we have loss of moral consensus.
Yeah.
And disrespect for law. And the next one was
not
loathing of yourself.
Yeah.
Right? And the next one was addiction. Well, in my mind, the transgender phenomenon is like an addiction because it's so widespread at the moment. Can it be? I mean, are these people depressed?
Yes, many of them.
So loathe themselves that it can be treated as an addiction.
I don't know.
Well, I'm asking the psychiatrist.
Well, there's a certain segment that I see that is pretty. There's simply a crass interest in thrill seeking.
But why?
Well, because the prison is boring, as I said.
He's in a prison setting. Prison is boring. It makes it more interesting.
I mean, the growth of this phenomenon is phenomenal.
Yeah.
But are these people depressed?
Well, yeah, but there hasn't been an acute outbreak of depression.
It's borderline personality disorder, and they're depressed.
Yeah.
But this isn't a drug. It's the whole process from extra appointments to extra blood draws to extra long sessions of your doctor scratching his head over hypokalemia, you know, all this stuff. It's like a sham, craniotomy or something. It's almost like a Munchausen kind of thing when you think about it.
Well, it's got some of that attached to it, hasn't it? Yeah.
On an unconscious level, you're really abusing yourself.
Yeah.
Additional medical attention.
Yeah. They do say in the early years after it's done that they're happier with their body but not happier as people.
I would agree with that.
Yeah. But that doesn't last long because then they find they can't get a date.
When you get your pulmonary embolus.
Yes, and all the other problems that come after that, yes. Okay. Tomorrow, to more misfortunes. Yeah. No.